speak up for the little ones, helpless and half abandoned. They've got a right to choose life they don't want to lose. I've got to speak up, won't you?
All right, ladies and gentlemen, that's Phil Keaggy from 1980. A lot of memories coming back right now on this edition of the program. I joined the pro-life movement, I'm going to say roughly 1982, 1983. The song from Phil Keaggy, very influential at the time. We brought Phil Keaggy to our campus at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo. I'm going to say about 1983, 1984. I was the host for that, and we were organizing the Coalition of American Pro-Life University Students. Of course, I ran for student body president of the university as the pro-life candidate. Eventually ran for governor of Colorado as the pro-life candidate in 1994, and then on to the U.S. Senate seat competition in 1998. Both candidates, both Republican and Democrat candidates, were avidly pro-abortion, wanting government funding to pay for more killing of innocent children. In 1994, 1998, I felt there should be a candidate who would stand up for life. So that's been the commitment for a long time. I sponsored the Personhood Amendment in Colorado about 9 years ago. Planned Parenthood took me to the Colorado Supreme Court on a technicality. We won, but lost the Personhood Amendment fight 3 times in the state. And there's a bit of frustration, I think, as I've been on the front lines of the pro-life movement for some 40 years now. And it could be that we are losing ground. I believe we are losing ground. I think there's an appearance of progress with the 15 to 20 states that appear to be adding pro-life legislation. I'm going to ask the question, is this a mirage? Because, hey, we're at about 7.75 million abortions minimum this year, up from 2 to 3 million abortions per year back in 1999. So it's about double to triple the number of abortions if you include the massive increase of IUD abortions. And we have no idea how many abortions as a result of the abortifacient pill. But whatever the case, we know this is a data point that we are double to triple the number of abortions right now as we had in the 1990s. The pro-life movement's very happy with all the progress, but sorry, there isn't much progress happening. From my perspective, and folks know about some of my frustrations because we have aired these things from time to time on the program. But why is this happening? Why are we losing ground? Is it something lacking in the fundamental commitment to righteousness, to the principles of God's word on the part of pro-lifers? Is it our fault? Is it the fault of the church? Is it the fault of the pro-life activists that pretend that they're doing something good, but in the end are not doing all that much? Now, not to minimize the folks that stand in front of abortion clinics and do the counseling, sidewalk counseling, those that have adopted the children who would have been aborted. There have been many good stories happening along the lines. We've been on the front lines. We've been out there interacting with moms in front of the abortion clinics, pleading and praying for them that they would not sacrifice their children to the idol of convenience. So we've been out there. We've had opportunities. We've seen the saves. 40 Days for Life is setting a record right now for baby saves. So we're thankful for what is going on, but we're losing ground. And why are we losing ground? Well, maybe this interview might be of some assistance, and so we're going to jump on with Bradley Pierce, an attorney from Texas. He's executive director of the Foundation to Abolish Abortion and Abolish Abortion Texas as well, and now joins me on Generations. Bradley, welcome back to the Generations broadcast. It's good to have you back with us.
Thank you, Kevin. It's an honor to be with you.
Let's talk a little bit about what's going on with this incrementalism. I just want to kind of open it up with that. You've witnessed some of this incrementalism that's going on, and do you see this as the sort of the fundamental problem with what's happening these days?
You know, I think you could reduce it to that word, and I think it's important to define what we're talking about when we use that. You know, I think everything in human history happens by increments, right? God created time, and everything that we do happens chronologically. One moment at a time, one step at a time. So in some ways, everything in life happens in increments, but that's different from incrementalism.
Yeah.
Incrementalism is really, you know, you could really phrase it another way, which is pragmatism. Mm-hmm. And I believe we could even put it another way, a more biblical way, and that is walking by sight rather than walking by faith. Mm-hmm. And it's being willing to compromise, not just, you know, getting one victory at a time, but even compromising our principles in the pursuit of just getting as much as we think that we currently can, given our predictions about the future. And as we see throughout Scripture, when people do that and they start walking by faith and just kind of what they assume the future is going to look like and what they predict it looks like, when they kind of, you know, walk in their own wisdom, that's not, you know, God's plan for the way that we should be walking. And that's, and I believe it's a big reason why we have not seen success in the pro-life movement. It's kind of like the children of Israel. God promised in the promised land. He told them to go in, but you know, they had a reality check, or they thought it was. They went in there and they saw the giants. They said, "We're like grasshoppers. The land devours its people. We don't think that we can do it," even though God had promised it to them. And so they began walking by sight and not by faith, and they began relying on human wisdom rather than God's wisdom. And I think that's been the Achilles heel of the pro-life movement for the last 40 years.
Let's talk about personhood just for a moment. Some state laws do maintain that personhood begins at fertilization. Kill a pregnant woman, the law treats that as a double homicide. Is that every state?
It's not every state, but it is most of the states across the country.
Okay.
That have some sort of feticide law, and they may even define a person, you know, for purposes of homicide, to be a person from the moment of fertilization. So there's lots of states where we have personhood on the books, and even when it comes to homicide, but that's not enough, and that's a big that's a big problem there. The personhood and getting that definition is not enough. What we really have to do in addition to that is take to its logical conclusion, and that is, well, how do we treat persons? And our law needs to reflect that. And then we also have to go and we have to challenge, you know, Roe versus Wade, and not just challenge it, but we have to challenge the very concept of judicial supremacy. That is the Supreme Court the final word on this subject? Yeah. And that's something that we haven't been willing to do.
Yeah. What is the goal of the pro-life lobby in America? Or what has it been to date? Do they really want to outlaw abortion?
You know, I mean, it's hard to say what everybody's reasons are. You know, I think there are a lot of people who do want to outlaw abortion. I think there's a lot of people who just want to make abortion safe, legal, and rare, which used to be the motto of the pro-choice movement. But now a lot of the pro-life movement has now adopted that. And a lot of the bills put forward by the pro-life movement are designed to do that. You know, it's treating abortion like it's healthcare and like it's something that we want to sanitize rather than a crime that we want to outlaw. So I can't speak for the entire pro-life movement, but certainly the bills that we're seeing across the country, you know, don't look like we're really trying to completely outlaw it. It looks like we're trying to sanitize it. It looks like we're trying to minimize it. But, you know, not that we're trying to outlaw it like it's a crime.
I was really surprised to hear that in 1857, a mother could not be prosecuted for abortion in Texas. And now that ties in the Roe v. Wade, doesn't it?
It really does. And a lot of people aren't familiar with this. So for a long time, for the pro-life movement, at the time of Roe versus Wade even, the mother has been immune from any sort of prosecution or legal consequences, or even being subject to any kind of liability at all for, you know, even those who willingly, who have capacity, who know what they're doing, they're not being forced, take their child to an abortion clinic. The law has given them immunity. And every pro-life bill written, even since Roe versus Wade, or almost all of them across the country, has continued that. They've explicitly given mothers immunity for their actions, even for, you know, even in partial birth abortion situations. And that's actually something that it's not just since Roe versus Wade. That was actually the case far before Roe versus Wade. And it's ultimately, I believe, a big reason why we lost Roe versus Wade in 1973 and why we've been losing it ever since. Because if we really believe that a fetus is a person, then the laws that protect born persons should be the same laws that protect people before they're born.
You say it should be wrong for a woman to kill her baby an hour after birth as well as an hour before birth.
Yes, that would be providing them what the Constitution calls equal protection, which in the 14th Amendment of the Constitution, it says no state shall deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the laws. And so our laws in 1973 and even all the way back to 1857 here in Texas, did not treat a what they call fetus as a person from the moment of fertilization. And that's what the Supreme Court actually picked up on that in 1973. And they mentioned that in their opinion. The Supreme Court actually says in their, this came up in oral arguments. The attorneys for Jane Roe argued this. The justices asked about it. And then it ended up actually in the Roe versus Wade majority opinion where the justices said, they said, you know, in arguing that a fetus is a person under the 14th Amendment, Texas faces a dilemma. If a fetus is a person, why is the mother not a principal or an accomplice? And that's a direct quote from the Supreme Court. And wow. If a fetus is a person, why are the penalties different? And that's another direct quote directly from the Supreme Court. And so that's, you know, we were in our court arguing that a fetus is a person, but none of our laws were treating them like they were a person. And the Supreme Court just said, actions speak louder than words, and we're going to take what you're already doing to its logical conclusion. You're not treating them like a person, so neither are we.
So gut feel, why? Why does everybody want to exempt the mother from killing her baby? Why are they doing this?
Yeah, I mean, historically, there were some reasons that were, legal and based on rules of evidence, based on, you know, how are we, you know, the abortionist is the primary perpetrator here, and so we want to get them, and there's a rule of that any evidence by a principal or an accomplice has to be corroborated by other evidence, which, you know, before the advent of modern technology, it was much harder to corroborate that an abortion had taken place. And so in some places, they said that the mother was immune for those reasons, not because she wasn't, you know, morally guilty of, you know, soliciting someone to kill her own child, but for evidentiary purposes, because they really wanted to go after the abortionist. But even at that time, that argument was not a great one. But even today, it makes no sense whatsoever, given that all the evidence and forensic technology that we have to corroborate and to demonstrate that an abortion took place, regardless of whether the mother testifies or not.
Yeah.
But that was a big argument. And, I think ultimately it just came down to that, throughout human history, we see humans devaluing, other people and treating them as subhumans in order to, justify their mistreatment of them.
Yeah.
And we saw that, you know, we've seen that with people based on the color of their skin. We've seen that with people based on their ethnic background. And we're seeing that and have seen that for a long time, even before Roe versus Wade. We've been doing that based upon just where someone's, you know, where someone resides, which is in the womb of their mother.
You would acknowledge, though, that some women do allow for an abortion, so to speak, under duress. Say threatened by a husband who says he's going to leave her if she doesn't kill the child. Those sorts of situations still exist.
Absolutely, they do. So there are certainly cases that are, that where people are under duress and they're being forced to do something under, you know, threat of death or serious bodily injury. There are definitely situations where people really don't know what they're doing. There are certainly situations where there may be, you know, medical triage situations that need to happen. But those situations actually do not require us to create some exception to homicide, to outlawing homicide. There are already what are called justifications or defenses in our penal codes or criminal codes across the country. And those are called duress for mothers in those situations, or they're called mistake of fact for those who truly don't know what they're doing, or they're called necessity for those who are in, you know, medical triage situations. So we don't really need to go create a bunch of exceptions for the situations you're talking about there. Our law already provides for those. And so that's why what we need to do is take the existing law that we already have that protects born people. And yes, has justifications and exceptions to be considered by judges and juries on a case by case basis. But you just take that body of law that we already have that protects born people and just apply it to people before they're born. But that's something that the pro-life movement has been refusing to do for over 48 years.
Now, Bradley, how do you view these bills that are just popping up everywhere in some of the more conservative states, the partial birth abortion bills, the fetal pain bill, the heartbeat bill? In fact, the heartbeat bill has had a huge controversy in Texas. It's been up to the Supreme Court at least once. It's going again here shortly. This is a big deal in Texas, but what's your take on it?
Well, I think getting back to something you talked about early on, you know, how have we gotten where we are? And it's like a lot of things that I know you've talked about and observed and told people about. Like a lot of things, you know, where we've gone wrong is where we've gotten away from God's word, is where we've gotten away from his standard for what is justice and what is a just law and what's a just bill that we should be putting forward. You know, when it comes to this issue, God's standards are very clear. God makes murder a crime. God gives the sword to the civil government, and it makes it clear that they're not to bear it in vain. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed, right? That was the first command when God instituted civil government, was to the protection and providing justice for the destruction of innocent life. So that's something that we should be doing. Then we see God's other commands to magistrates, like, you know, do not show partiality in judgment. Do not oppress the fatherless. Do not have differing weights and measures. The problem is with all of these, you know, the bills of the pro-life lobby, partial birth abortion, 20-week ban, 15-week ban, 8-week ban, heartbeat bill, all of them violate all of those standards. They show partiality in judgment. They oppress those who don't yet, you know, who haven't yet reached those standards. They discriminate against them and treat them as subhuman who have not yet reached those various thresholds. And ultimately, they don't treat abortion like God treats it. God treats it like it's a crime and tells us to do so. In fact, God says in Leviticus, he says that if someone sacrifices their child to Molech, which is basically the example at the time of what they were doing and what we're doing today, if someone does that, then the community is to provide justice, right, as God's delegated that to them. And he says that if the people of the land would all close their eyes to that person and do not provide justice, do not execute justice, then God will judge that person. But, and then God will also judge the people of the land because they have failed in that duty. And so that's why, you know, all these bills that we're seeing, they fall short of God's standard. They do not treat it like it's a crime. They don't treat it like it's a sin. You know, how many people do we go to and we say, hey, I know you're involved in this horrific sin. You know, can you just do it between the hours of noon and 4 p.m.? Or can you just do it 75% less? Or can you just do it to people who are, you know, over 10 years of age, right? I mean, that would be ridiculous. Mm-hmm. But that's how we're treating abortion when it comes to the pro-life bills that the pro-life lobby has been pushing for the last 48 years.
Well, we hear the pragmatic argument, yeah, but this one's going to save some lives. Of course, I wonder if even that's going to be true. If you're going to get an abortion, you've only got 6 weeks to make that decision. I suppose the heartbeat bills are prejudicial against procrastinators, you know, people who just, you know, just keep putting it off. But 6 weeks seems to be a pretty good margin of time in which to make a decision as to whether you're going to kill your child or not, it seems to me. I don't want to be cynical about it, but, you know, thinking, you know, from the perspective of a pro-abort, you would think that 6 weeks is a pretty good margin of time to make that decision if you're going to kill the child.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. It's not funny, really, that you say that. I mean, in a lot of ways, we could call the heartbeat bill a hurry up and get an abortion bill. And I think it could end up causing more abortions because people that may have delayed, may have just, hey, see how healthy this baby is, things like that. They're going to rush into that decision even faster. But like you said, they still have 6 weeks. And actually, Governor Abbott here in Texas, he was asked by a reporter just a couple of weeks ago, asked him, hey, this bill doesn't provide exceptions for rape and incest. Are you okay with that? And his response was so sad. He said, oh, well, there's still 6 weeks. You know, the bill still provides, that was the word he used, provides. The bill still provides 6 weeks to go get that abortion. And that's the problem, right? That's the problem with the bills that the pro-life lobby's been putting forward and that we've been, you know, supporting because we think it's all we can get. And we've fallen short of God's standard. And so the bills that we're writing and supporting and celebrating provide 6 weeks for people to go get an abortion, not just for rape and incest, but for any reason.
I wonder if this is a commitment issue, a commitment to God, a commitment to God's principles in the hearts of our people. I mean, I'm talking about the conservatives. I'm talking about Christians. Seems to me that we're just too lukewarm. This is the Laodicean issue. We're so lukewarm. The commitment is so shallow that I'm wondering if anybody could ever win this pro-life battle until we become more committed to the principle itself.
I think that's true. I mean, it really comes down to the way that I put it. I say, do you believe that Roe versus Wade should be overturned? Number two, do you believe that a fetus is a person? And number three, do you really believe those things? That is, do your actions, are they consistent with those things? Because if you believe that Roe versus Wade should be overturned, then you believe it's unconstitutional, because that's the only legal basis to overturn it. And if you believe it's unconstitutional, well, the supreme law of the land is the Constitution and laws made in pursuance of the Constitution. But if you believe it's unconstitutional, then it's not supreme law of the land. So why are we following it in our states? And then if you believe that a fetus is a person, then that means that under the 14th Amendment, no state shall deny to them the equal protection of the law. But the laws protect foreign people should protect them too. If you're being consistent, you should require that the bill that you would support provides equal protection. And that is, the laws protect foreign people before they're born just the same. And that would apply to mothers too. Now on the mothers thing, you know, no one's saying that every single mother who's no one's saying go proactive on it. And additionally, you know, no one is saying that every single mother should get the same outcome, right? We're not talking about equality of punishment or equality of application of the law. We're talking about equality, equal protection under the laws or of the laws. That is, that the law should be non-discriminatory, should treat people, whether born or unborn, the same, equally made in the image of God, equally valuable. And then for every kind of sympathetic case out there, and there are many, those should be decided and handled on a case-by-case basis by our justice system, just like how we protect born people. And so if you really believe that Roe should be overturned and you really believe that a fetus is a person, then do you act like it? You know, do your actions reflect that belief? If they do, then you will be standing up and saying, no, we should not be obeying Roe versus Wade because it's not the law of the land, because it's unconstitutional. And yes, we should be providing equal protection of the laws because these babies in their mother's wombs are persons, both under the Constitution and, more importantly, in God's eyes.
So let's be clear here. The reversal of Roe v. Wade will turn the criminal question back to the states. In other words, the reversal of Roe v. Wade doesn't introduce some kind of a federal crime to abortion. It would just simply revert the decision back to state legislatures and state judicial systems. And at that point, now the states have to do something. The states have to act one way or the other.
Probably. So the court has a couple of options there. You know, if they could overturn Roe versus Wade and just return it to the state, or they could go further and hold that a fetus is a person under the 14th Amendment. And if they are, then that would require that the states not deny them the equal protection of the law. So the Supreme Court under the 14th Amendment could go much further, and they could say, Hey, states are required to provide equal protection. Now, I don't think anyone expects that they will do that anytime soon, if ever. So, you know, the more plausible, you know, path for the Supreme Court would be to overturn it and to return it to the states.
And your goal would be at least one state in America or somewhere in the world, there would be a protection of the unborn child somewhere.
Absolutely. We have to start somewhere. And that's why I talked about earlier, like about increments, right?
Yeah.
We're fully supportive of it, you know, happening one state at a time. And those are godly increments, we believe. But incrementalism, where we, you know, where we sacrifice and compromise the standards and the principles in order to achieve a pragmatic victory, that's not okay. So yes, I would love for a state to stand up and to say, no, not in our state. We are going to do our duty as magistrates before God and protect innocent life in our state, regardless of what five justices on the Supreme Court say.
Folks, we must have a commitment to righteousness. God calls us to love mercy, exercise justice, and walk humbly before our God. That's basic for Christians. And certainly the pro-life issue is the crying need for the day in terms of God's standards of righteousness in the public sphere. And Christians should take that stand. And that's been our encouragement for years on this radio program. I hope this has been helpful to those of you who are committed to principle and seeking a godly strategy to be the salt, yeast, and light that God has called us to be in society. Bradley Pierce has been my guest, attorney from Texas, executive director of the Foundation to Abolish Abortion, Abolish Abortion Texas. You can visit the websites online, of course. Bradley, thank you for joining us on Generations. Appreciate the work, and I think this has been a helpful conversation.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
This is Kevin Swanson inviting you back again next time as we continue to lay down a vision for the next generation.